I'm in big trouble because of my sermon today. Generally, I start to write, and I write until I have about 9 or 12 pages of notes, and then I know that I have enough material. So when I always print out a backup. I read the notes from the computer because it's easier to see. But I always print a backup just in case for any reason if my computer would crash, I'd have something to say. And when I printed it, it wasn't printing correctly, and I realized that I had the file set up for legal paper. So instead of 12 pages of notes, I actually have 16. And I was wondering why it was taking me forever to write this thing, and now I know. But I won't drag you over time. Well, we heard about telling the truth in the children's Bible time this morning. How do you feel about the messages that are coming from our nation's leaders? Do you have confidence in what they're saying, that they're telling us the truth? Do you believe the explanations that our congressmen deliver in the, for the plans and the policies that they're pursuing? For instance, do you believe in global warming and that men and men's activities are responsible for elevating the temperatures on planet Earth? Do we believe that? Or rather, do we see hidden agendas and pretexts? Do we see spin and lies? In an attempt to manipulate us, to exert control, to shape and mold our thinking, and perhaps to create anxiety and panic sometimes, and dependence on government. I was listening to Meet the Press or one of these shows several years ago, and the man said a remarkable thing. He said, if you tell a lie in Washington three times, it becomes a fact. And I thought, yeah, that's probably true, unfortunately. People don't question what their leaders are saying, and they begin to accept what's being said. And if you repeat a lie enough times, it becomes a sort of a truth. We're becoming increasingly skeptical year by year of the information that we hear coming from our nation's capital. We've lost faith and trust in our government and our leaders. And it appears that in November, the voters may be prepared to express some of the displeasure for that reason and for other reasons with our elected officials for the lies and the misrepresentations that they have steadily fed us for several years. Let's turn over to Isaiah chapter 59. We see ourselves today in the same condition that existed in ancient Judah in the time of Isaiah. Isaiah 59 and verse 12. He says, our transgressions are multiplied before you, and our sins testify against us. For our transgressions are with us, and as for our iniquities, we know them. In transgressing and lying against the Lord, and departing away from our God, speaking oppression and revolt, conceiving and uttering from the heart words of falsehood, and judgment is turned away backward, and there is very little apparent good judgment coming out of our government today. Government is turned away backward, and justice stands afar off, for the truth is fallen in the street, and equity cannot enter. I don't know how you feel about it, but that's the way I feel about what I hear coming out of Washington today. The truth has fallen in the street. Yes, the truth has failed, and he that departs from evil makes himself a prey. And the Lord saw it, and it displeased him, and that there was no judgment. And the world of politics is full of lies, of guile, dirty tricks, hidden agendas, pretexts, deceit. The truth doesn't have a chance of escaping from our nation's capital. Let's turn over to John, the first chapter. We're going to look at a contrasting example. God values very highly the truth, as Bonnie told the children, and he has a high regard for the values of those whose heart is pure in the truth and clean from lies and deceit. So in John 1, it's telling a story about how Christ gathered to himself some of his disciples, and a remarkable example is made of one of the disciples in the first chapter of John. Let's go to verse 43. It says, the following day, Jesus wanted to go to Galilee, and he found Philip and said to him, follow me. Now, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. And Philip found Nathanael and said to him, we have found him of whom Moses wrote in the law, also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. Nathanael said to him, can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Philip said to him, come and see. So when Jesus met Nathanael, he said something remarkable to him, and there's more in the story than we have generally recognized. Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him, and he said, "Behold," he said, he made an example of Nathanael. He said, "Look at this. Here is an Israelite indeed in whom there is no deceit." Why did Christ say that? Perhaps because of the history of guile and deception and dirty tricks that had plagued the family of Abraham throughout generations. Nathanael was a contrasting example of transparency and honesty and integrity. And going down to verse 48, I'm going to switch to the New Revised Standard Version. And excuse me, because I'm just having a hard time finding a combination of optics that's working for me today. Nathanael asked him, "Where did you get to know me?" And Jesus answered and said, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." And Jesus answered, "Do you believe me because I told you I saw you under the fig tree? You're going to see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Truly I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." So there's more to what Christ has said here than we generally recognize. We're all familiar with euphemisms, and I was trying to think of a positive one that's like the euphemism that Christ used here, and I couldn't think of one. I thought of over the hill. If somebody says to you, "You're over the hill," he doesn't mean you're figuratively over the hill. He means, you know what he means. And if you say to, if you describe somebody as being on the wagon, you mean he stopped drinking. But if you refer to him as being three sheets to the wind, that means he hasn't, right? Well, that's the kind of figure of speech that Christ was using here, because the commentaries point out, and I won't go through them, but you can check Adam Clark and John Gill in the New Bible Dictionary. Since I'm going to be out of time, I won't read them to you. But to be under the fig tree meant to be engaged in Bible study, and this was a tradition that started with the rabbis. They would study their Bibles traditionally under a fig tree. So if you said somebody was under the fig tree, he wasn't literally, didn't necessarily have to be under a fig tree. He might have been studying his Bible. Well, Nathanael might have been under a fig tree, but on the other hand, Jesus may have been employing a euphemism indicating that he had seen Nathanael during a period of Bible study. So if anybody can think of a euphemism like that that's positive, help me out here, because I could only think of over the hill, on the wagon, or three sheets to the wind. So those are all the kind of euphemisms that we use. If anyone thinks of a positive one, just shoot your hand up, because I need to know it. It's been troubling me for weeks now. But Christ was making an example of Nathanael because he was a man of character, resulting from his study of the Scriptures and the application of the Scriptures. Well, can we know, when Christ saw Nathanael studying under the fig tree, what was Nathanael studying? Christ's further comments give us a clue as to what Nathanael had been studying. In verse 51, Christ says, "Truly I say to you, hereafter you shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." Let's turn over to Genesis 28. Can anybody remember an example in the Bible that's kind of like this, that Christ might have been alluding to, giving us a clue as to what Nathanael had been studying? I think Nathanael was studying Genesis 28. I think he was studying the life of Jacob. Jacob, one of the most treacherous and deceitful characters in the Bible. Somebody, if you shook hands with him, you'd want to count your fingers afterwards, wouldn't you? So Genesis 28, verse 10, Jacob went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran, and he lighted upon a certain place. And he stayed there all night because the sun was set, and he took stones of that place and put them for his pillow, and he lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it, just like Christ had said. So Christ was alluding to this example in Genesis. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, "I am the Lord, God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac, and the land whereon you lie, to you I will give it, and to your seed. And the seed shall be as your seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, to the north and the south, and in thee and in your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed." So it's likely, although it's not an ironclad statement, but it's likely that Nathanael was studying the life of Jacob one of the most deceitful characters in the Bible. And Jesus had pointed out Nathanael as a contrast to the patriarch Jacob. So let's talk a little bit about Jacob and his family, because the book of Genesis lists the deceptions of the family of Jacob, and it's an amazing litany of lies and dirty tricks. And again, there is more in the symbolism surrounding the things that the family of Jacob did to each other. There are some things in the symbolism of what was going on there that we generally don't recognize that I'd like to highlight today. So I guess maybe it all started with Abraham. Abraham lied about his relationship with Sarah in Genesis 12. He deceived the Pharaoh. And then he did the same thing again in Genesis 20. He deceived another dynastic ruler, Abimelech. Then Isaac pulled the same trick, perhaps on a descendant of that Abimelech. Isaac lied about his relationship with Rebekah in Genesis 26. And we remember that Simeon and Levi pulled a dirty trick on the inhabitants of Shechem, tricked them into being circumcised, and when they were weak from the pain of that operation, they slaughtered the whole bunch of them. So that certainly was a dirty trick and a deception. We remember that Jacob literally stole Esau's birthright as the firstborn. Jacob's name, by the way, means supplanter or usurper. A more common term might be cheat today that we would use. So let's turn over to Genesis 25 to read about how Esau was tricked out of his birthright by a bowl of soup, and we're all familiar with this story. We'll just skim through it quickly. Genesis 25, verse 29. Jacob sod pottage, I presume that means he made a bowl of soup. And Esau came in from the field, and he was faint. And Esau said to Jacob, "Feed me, I pray, with that same red soup, for I am faint." And therefore his name was called Edom, which means red soup. And Jacob said, "Sell me this day your birthright, and swear to me this day." And he swore unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. And then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he didn't drink. And he rose up, and he went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. And in the New Testament, I think it's in Hebrews, he's referred to as a profane person for having so lightly undervalued that birthright. Let's go now to Genesis 27, because we'll learn about the second dirty trick that Jacob played on his father, Isaac, and on his brother, Esau. Genesis 27, Rebekah hatches a plot, and Jacob is complicit in it. And as the plot begins to unfold, the devices of this deception and the plot are elements that continue to appear and reappear in the family of Jacob for generations. So Genesis 27, verse 1. And God is trying to tell us something by the repeated use of these symbolic elements. It came to pass that when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim, that he couldn't see, he called to Esau, his eldest son. And he said unto him, "My son." And he said unto him, "Behold, here I am." And he said, "Behold, now I'm old, and I don't know the day of my death. Now therefore take, I pray you, your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, go out to the field, and take me some venison. Make me savory meat, such as I love." He must have loved Mexican food, that's all I can say. "Take some savory meat, such as I love, and bring it to me, that I may eat." Because he couldn't tell the difference between venison and goat. So that it must have had a lot of taco spices in it, that's all I can say. "And bring it to me that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." And Rebekah heard when Isaac spoke to Esau, his son. And Esau went to the field to hunt venison and to bring it. And Rebekah spoke to Jacob, her son, saying, "Behold, I heard your father speak to Esau, your brother, saying, 'Bring me venison, make me savory meat that I may eat, and bless you before the Lord before my death. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to that which I command you. Go now to the flock and fetch me from thence two good kids of the goats." And it's important that these were goats that he was going to use. "And I will make them savory meat for your father, such as he loves. And you shall bring it to your father that he may eat, that he may bless you before his death." And Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Listen, Esau, my brother, is a hairy guy, and I'm a smooth man. My father, peradventure, will feel me, and I shall seem to him like a deceiver, and I shall bring a curse upon me, and not a blessing. And his mother said unto him, Upon me be your curse, my son. Only obey my voice, and go fetch me them. And he went, and he fetched and brought them to his mother, and his mother made savory meat, such as his father loved. And Rebekah took goodly raiment. This is the second element. First element, the symbolically, is goat meat. And now clothing comes into play. And Rebekah took goodly raiment of her eldest son Esau. So she's going to perpetrate a deception, and the two elements are goats and clothing. So she took Esau's clothing, which was in the house, and she put them on Jacob, her younger son. And she put skins of the kids of the goats upon his hands and upon the smooth of his neck. And she gave the savory meat and the bread which she had prepared unto the hand of her son Jacob. So the devices of this deception are clothing and goat's meat and goat's skins. Now, I'll just read to you Genesis 25:25. It says, talking about the birth of Esau and Jacob, it says, when the first came out, that's Esau, he came out red all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. Now, Jacob is going to disguise himself as Esau, and he's going to cover his neck and his forearms with goat skin. Now, Esau must have been one hairy guy. This just conjures up an image for me, and I should have brought the projector, but for those of you in the back, this is Lon Chaney as the Wolf Man. And this is how I imagine Esau must have looked for Jacob to be able to disguise himself with a set of hairy goat skins. So I guess if you go to the internet tonight, you could Google Lon Chaney as the Wolf Man, and you might see a picture that wasn't far off of how hairy Esau really was. Let's turn over to Exodus 19. So the two elements in this deception are goats and goat's meat, goat skin, and clothing. And as I said, the elements keep these elements of goats and clothing keep appearing in deception and dirty trick after dirty trick in the lineage of Jacob. And God is trying to tell us something. So what do these symbols mean? What for the Christian, what does the symbol of clothing mean? I can't read all the scriptures, otherwise we'll be here until 6:30. But Exodus 19, verse 10, God is telling Moses how the people have to prepare themselves to meet him at the foot of Mount Sinai. And he tells them in verse 14, he tells them to wash their clothes. It was important that they would wash their clothes. And when Jacob was going to meet God face to face, just mark down Genesis 35:1-3. God told him, put away the strange gods that are among you, and he wanted the whole family of Jacob to be clean and to change your garments. In Job 25:14, Job says, I put on righteousness. And we keep seeing this throughout the New Testament. We're told to put on something. And Job is talking about putting on righteousness. He says, and it clothed me. Job says, I put on righteousness and it clothed me. In Revelation 3:5, Christ says, he that overcomes, the same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life. And in Galatians 3:27, please look these up later, for as many of you as have been baptized into Christ have put on Christ. And the word put on is a Greek word that means don like clothing. We are to put on the righteousness of Jesus Christ like clothing. And in Ephesians 4:24, it says, after you have put on the new man, same word, enduo, it means to don a garment, put on the new man, which is after God created in righteousness and holiness. So the Greek word enduo, which is used several times in the New Testament, means to don clothing. And our clothing is typical. The clothing that we're wearing is typical of the Christian life and of righteousness. But in the family of Abraham, the clothing that they're wearing is not the clothing of righteousness. It's the clothing of lies and deceit. The goat is also a red flag and a warning. The goat in Scripture also has an unfavorable connotation. best example I can think of is in Matthew 25. Let's go ahead and turn there. Matthew 25, verse 31. Christ is talking about final accounting. Matthew 25, verse 31. When the Son of Man shall come in His glory, and all the holy angels with Him, then shall He sit upon the throne of His glory, and before Him shall be gathered all the nations. And He shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divides his sheep from the goats. And He shall set the sheep on His right hand, but the goats on His left. And then the king shall say unto them on His right hand, not to the goats, but to the sheep, Come, you blessed of My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. So the goat in symbol seems to be God's way of indicating that the characters in the family of Jacob are going their own way, because goats are not easily led as are sheep. Goats go their own way. They're depending, the family of Abraham, the family of Jacob, they're depending on their own resources. They're not depending on God and on His word and what He said and trusting God to work things out. They're going their own way. They're taking the lead like a goat. So Rebekah, when she urged Jacob to deceive his father Isaac, she began a chain of deception which affects the lives of their descendants even to this day. And the symbols of raiment or clothing and goats continue to surface for generations in the lives of Rebekah's families as deception and trickery and lying propagate throughout their family. Well, of course, we know Jacob did deceive Isaac. His deception was successful. Let's turn over to Genesis 37 to see what happened after that. Because what Jacob and Rebekah started was a chain that continued through their family. In Genesis 37, now, Jacob is an older man, and he has benefited from the deception that he perpetrated on his brother. And his favorite son, of course, is Joseph. And we know the story about how Joseph was given a coat of many colors as a token of Jacob's love for Joseph, this one son in particular. And, of course, we know that Joseph began to have dreams, and he told his unwisely, he told his brothers the dreams. And because Joseph was the favorite, and because Joseph seemed to have an elevated opinion of himself, the brothers hated Joseph. Now, as we pick up the story in Genesis 37, verse 25, the brothers have thrown Joseph into a pit, and they're just trying to decide whether to kill him or what they should do with him. Verse 25 says, they sat down to eat bread, and as they lifted up their eyes, behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices and balms and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. So Judah comes up with a bright idea. What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. If we slay our brother and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh, and his brothers were content. Then there passed Midianite merchantmen, and they drew and lifted Joseph up out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. And they brought Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben, who had planned to go and release Joseph from the pit, returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph wasn't there, and he rent his clothes. And he turned to his brothers and he said, the child is not, and what am I going to do now? And then they took Joseph's coat. So here we go again with the garment, the symbol of clothing. They took his coat. And what did they do? They killed a kid of the goats. So now they're going to use clothing and goat's blood to perpetrate another deception. This time, Jacob is on the receiving end of the deception. He's not the perpetrator, but he's getting a payback. And he's the symbols, the devices of this deception are exactly the same as the deception that he perpetrated on his father, clothing and goats. So they killed a kid of the goats and dipped the coat in the blood, and they set the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father, and they said, Father, we found this. Do you know what it is? Do you recognize this? Does this have any significance? So it's Joseph's coat covered with goat's blood, and of course in those days they couldn't discern goat's blood from human blood. And he knew it. He said, "It's my son's coat. An evil beast has devoured him." And Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces. So Jacob now pays for his deception of Isaac in exactly the same way, using exactly the same elements of deception as he had perpetrated on his own father. And this was Judah's idea. It was Judah's idea to sell Joseph and to use the goat's blood and the coat. Judah pays for this later. In every step in this chain, there is a payback. Jacob had deceived Isaac with a goat and clothing, and now he receives the payback with a double dose of irony. Joseph's coat of many colors is smeared with the blood of the goat. Jacob is reaping the harvest that he sowed by deceiving his own father. So let's turn over now to Genesis 29. This actually happened earlier in the life of Jacob. Jacob has, at this point, I'm sorry that I'm backtracking, at this point Jacob has deceived his father, Isaac, and has had to flee away from Esau and has taken refuge with Laban, his mother's brother, and he goes and works for Laban, and the deal is that he's going to work for Laban for 7 years, and after the 7 years he's going to be able to take Rachel as his wife. So Jacob indeed works for Laban for 7 years. And Jacob said, after the 7 years, in Genesis 29:21, Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go into her." And Laban gathered together all the men of the place, made a feast. Perhaps Jacob had a little too much to drink. Came to pass in the evening that he didn't take Rachel, his daughter. He took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him. And he went into unto her. And Laban gave unto him his daughter Leah, Zilpah, her maid for a handmaid. And it came to pass that in the morning, a startling and terrifying revelation, Jacob wakes up with Leah in bed with him and not Rachel. And he said to Laban, "What have you done to me? Didn't I serve you 7 years for Rachel? Wherefore, then, have you beguiled me? You tricked me. You pulled a really dirty trick on me." And Laban said, "Well, it must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week, and we will give you this also for the service which you shall serve me yet another 7 years." So Rachel, or Leah, must have been dressed in Rachel's bridal clothing. Clothing is, again, the mechanism of this deception. And I wonder if Jacob perceived the fantastic irony of this payback, because that's what it is. It's a payback. He cheated Esau out of his right as the firstborn, and now Jacob is cheated because of somebody else's right as the firstborn. It was Leah's right to be married before her sister. So the irony in the story is just fantastic. But after that, Laban gets paid back for his deception of palming off Leah instead of Rachel. In Genesis 30, let's not turn there, I'll just summarize it for you. Genesis 30, Joseph begins some sort of a selective breeding program to increase his wealth and his the size and the strength and the vitality of his flocks at the expense of Laban's. So the bottom line is, in Genesis 31:1, after many years of some sort of selective breeding program where his flocks and herds increase and Laban's diminish, Genesis 31:1, Jacob heard the words of Laban's son saying, "Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and all that which was our father's, he has gotten all his glory." So Laban and Joseph agree that all the stock that is striped or spotted or brown will be Jacob's. And Jacob begins some kind of a selective breeding program to favor speckled, striped, spotted sheep and goats. So Laban receives the payback for his deception with Leah. And again, the element of goats are certainly involved in the symbol of the goat as part of the mechanism of this deception. Now, I told you that Judah was going to receive a payback for his part of the deception and trying to convince his father, Jacob, that Joseph had been slaughtered by some wild animal. You remember he had sold him into slavery and had his clothing smeared with goat's blood. Judah decides to cheat his daughter-in-law regarding a promise involving the levirate marriage. So we're going to go now to Genesis 38. Let's turn over to Genesis 38, verse 6. Because Judah promises his third son, Shelah, as the husband to Tamar, but later reneges. He decides to cheat Tamar out of this promise that he's made to her. Genesis 38, 6. So you remember that if a man died and he didn't have children, it was his brother's responsibility to take the woman as a wife and raise up children for him. So Genesis 38, 6 says, Judah took a wife for Er's firstborn, whose name was Tamar. So Judah's firstborn was Er, his wife was Tamar. But Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. And Judah said unto Onan, go unto your brother's wife and marry her and raise up seed to your brother. And Onan refused to do that. And in verse 10 it says, the thing which he did displeased the Lord, therefore he slew him also. So then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow at your father's house till Shelah, my son, is grown. For he said, lest peradventure he die also as his brethren did. And Tamar believed him, and she went and dwelt in her father's house. And in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted. And he went up to the sheep shearers, to Timnath, he and his friend, Hirah the Adullamite. So Judah actually has no intention of giving his third son to Tamar as a husband. In Genesis 38, verse 13, it says, it was told Tamar, saying, behold, your father-in-law goes up to Timnath to shear sheep. So she decides to play a little dirty trick herself. She put off her widow's garment, and she covered her face with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in an open place, which is by the way to Timnath. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given unto him to wife. So she sees that Judah has reneged on his promise. Therefore, she dresses herself as a harlot. So we've got the element now of clothing as a disguise to deceive. And Judah turned unto her, by the way, and said, go, I pray, and let me come into you. For he knew not that this was his daughter-in-law. And she said, what will you give me that you may come unto me? And he said, I will send unto you a kid, a goat, from the flocks. So here we've got another deception running, and the elements of the deception are a disguise of clothing, and the payment here is supposed to be a goat. So the deception also involves the clothing of a prostitute and a goat. So she says to him, verse 17, what will you give me as a pledge till you send it? And he said, what pledge shall I give to you? And she says, your signet and your bracelet and your staff that's in your hand. So as time goes on, Judah later tries to send the payment for the services of this prostitute. He sends a goat in the hand of his friend, but they can't find the woman. And he asked of the men at that place in verse 21, saying, where is the harlot that was openly by the way here? And they said, well, there's no harlot in this place. And he returned to Judah, and he said, I can't find her. This is his friend. And also the men of the place said there was no harlot in the place. And Judah said, let her, take it to her, lest we be shamed. Behold, I send this kid, and you have not found her. And it came to pass that about 3 months after, it was told Judah, saying, Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot, and also, behold, she is with child by whoredom. And Judah said, bring her forth, and let her be burned. And when she was brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man whose these are, I am with child. And she said to Judah, discern these. Whose are these? In other words, just exactly what Judah had said to his father. Recognize this. So Judah is getting the same payback. He's getting a payback for the deception that he played on his father, Jacob. And Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because that I gave her not Shelah, my son, and he knew her not again. So Tamar deceives Judah with disguise of a harlot, and she gets a goat as payment, and she takes Judah's attire, his signet and bracelets, and staff as a pledge. She becomes pregnant. Judah's hypocrisy He had no intention of giving Shelah as Tamar's wife, yet he invokes the code of Hammurabi that demanded that Tamar would be burnt for adultery, as Tamar and Shelah were betrothed and technically they were married, although the marriage had not yet been consummated. So Judah wants her to be burned according to the code of Hammurabi, but she produces the pledge articles and says, just as Judah had said to his father years earlier, recognize these. This is exactly what Judah said when the brothers presented him, said to Jacob, when the brothers presented to Jacob the coat of many colors stained with goat's blood. So Judah gets his payback, deception with the trademark goat and attire. Finally, Joseph, having become the second man in the kingdom of Egypt, deceives his 10 brothers in an elaborate deception. But in the end, he ends the chain of deception. The brothers receive their reward, their payback. There's a little bit of vengeance there on the part of Jacob for the evil that they did to him. But for the most part, the chain of deception is ended by Joseph. Well, what do we learn from this elaborate story with these elements of goats and clothing being repeatedly used as trademarks of the deception being perpetrated through the lineage of Jacob? God was involved in this family, and God was involved in bringing about the details of how these deceptions worked out. And God was telling these people, you're like goats. I'm trying to lead you, but you're taking matters into your own hands and using lies and trickery and deceit. God hates lying and deceit. He's saying to them, your clothing ought to be the clothing of righteousness, but it's the clothing of deception. God hates lying and deceit. Let me just read you some scriptures, since I obviously don't have time to have us turn to them all. Proverbs 12:22. Lying lips are an abomination the Lord, but they that deal truly are his delight. God delights in people like Nathaniel, who have no guile in them, who have no hidden motives, no hidden agendas, no dirty tricks, but are open and honest. Proverbs 6, verse 16. These six things does the Lord hate. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked imaginations, feet that be swift in running to mischief, and a false witness that speaks lies, and he that sows discord among brethren. Well, Christ has told us, let's turn over to John 8. Christ has told us where lies and dirty tricks came from. Satan is the creator of lying. Jesus has told us that lying began with him. He was talking to the Pharisees in the 8th chapter of John. Let's go to verse 44. He had said to them, if you were the sons of Abraham, you would do the works of Abraham. But he says, you are of your father the devil in verse 44, and the lusts of the father you will do. He said, you are of your father the devil because they were doing his works. He was a murderer from the beginning and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it. Satan invented lying. Before Satan, nobody had thought to do a thing like that. No one had ever spoken anything except the truth. When someone gave God information, it was reliable. It could be counted on. But Satan somehow came up with an innovation, something completely new. No one had thought to provide disinformation for personal gain before. Why was lying necessary for Satan? Well, we're going to go to Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 to find the answer. But Satan invented it. It was a brand new concept. God undoubtedly had to coin a new word to describe this kind of aberrant behavior. Isaiah 14 and verse 12. And of course, you know where we're going after this. We're going to Ezekiel 28. Isaiah 14, verse 12, he says, how you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, which did weaken the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven, and I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the cloud. I will be the Most High. That's what Satan's ambition was, but he had to cover it up. He had to keep it secret. And I presume that he began a campaign of lying and of slander against God, as we'll see, in order to try to make this plot successful. Let's go now to Ezekiel 28. Ezekiel 28, verse 15, God says to Lucifer, "You were perfect in all your ways from the day that you were created until iniquity, lawlessness, was found in you. By the multitude of your merchandise, they have filled the midst of you with violence, and you have sinned. Therefore, I will cast you as profane out of the mountain of God, and I will destroy you, O covering cherub, from the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You have corrupted your wisdom by reason of your brightness. I will cast you to the ground. I will lay you before kings that they may behold you. You have defiled your sanctuaries with a multitude of your iniquities by the iniquity of your traffic. Therefore, I will bring a fire from the midst of you, and it will devour you, and I will bring you to ashes upon the earth in the sight of all them that behold you. All they that know you among the people shall be astonished at you. You shall be a terror, and you shall not be anymore." So the words merchandise and traffic carry the connotation of malice and slander. Satan attempted a palace coup. He intended to depose God, and he began a campaign of slander against God. And that's in line with the MO, the modus operandi, that we see of Satan working throughout the Bible to disaffect individuals by claiming that God has exploited and defrauded them. This was his strategy in trying to turn Adam and Eve against God and to cause them to sin. And he had to keep his slander campaign a secret from God as he attempted to seduce the angels. Let's turn over to Revelation 12. Revelation 12 tells us that he had some measure of success in turning the angels against their own creator. Revelation 12, verse 3. "There appeared another wonder in heaven. Behold, a great red dragon having seven heads and ten horns and seven crowns on his head." This is talking about Satan. "And his tail drew down the third part of the stars," the angels, "from heaven and did cast them to the earth." So Satan was successful in his malicious slander campaign against God and somehow convincing the angels that they had been defrauded, exploited, abused by God the Father. Satan, when he comes to an individual to cause discontent, his strategy is to tell us that God's motives are impure. And yet, only God's motives are the ones that can be trusted. God's motives are pure, and there is absolutely no hidden agenda. 1 John 1, verse 5 says, "This is the message which we have heard of him and declare to you, that God is light. There is nothing hidden with God." God didn't hide any of his objectives, any of his motives, any of his plans. God has laid all his plans out before us. God is light. It says that men love the darkness because their deeds were evil, and Satan's deeds were certainly evil, and he used the darkness of lying and deception to cover up what he was doing. But God is light. God floods his plan with light. God is light, and in him is no darkness at all. If we say that we have fellowship with him and walk in darkness, we lie and don't do the truth. But if we walk in the light, as he is in the light, we have fellowship one with another, and the blood of his Son, Jesus Christ, cleanses us from all sins. So God has no hidden agenda. He has made his agenda for mankind explicitly clear. It is not his plan to exploit or abuse his people. And it is impossible, as it says in Romans 3:4, it's impossible for God to lie. Actually, it says that in Hebrews. But Romans 3:4 says, "Let God be true, but every man a liar." So Satan invented lying to hide his true motives and his actions from God. But God was wise enough to discern his intentions. God had reserved enough resource of strength and might to defeat any such attempted coup. But the point is that if we lie, if we deceive, if we shade the truth, we are emulating the father of lies. He becomes, in that case, our father. When we're tempted to color the truth, to utter a falsehood, to trick or deceive, we must remember who invented this kind of perverse behavior. Now, in the life of Jacob and his descendants, God wove a continuous thread of common themes through our lives for several generations in the family of Jacob for our benefit, the recurring theme of goats and clothing as devices of deception show that God was involved in the process. And he was teaching our forebears, the patriarchs, to be honest and forthright through the hard teacher of experience. And God is involved in our lives as well. He can make things work out for good for us or in an adverse way, depending on our behavior and on our obedience. And sometimes we might be tempted to try to make things work out better for us by lying about things or trying to cover up mistakes that we've made. And we should not do that. We should tell the truth at all times, just as Bonnie taught the children this afternoon. Even if it's to our own hurt, even if what we say seems hurtful to us, in the long run, telling the truth is always the better course, the better strategy. Because God can make things work out for good or in an adverse way. And his motives in working with us and maybe allowing us to fall into trials are often traceable to his intention to teach us by experience. So perhaps we have lied in the past or deceived in the past, and how did that work out? We have to analyze, how did that work out for us? Did that work out as well as it could have? Because as it did in the family of Jacob, perpetrating a deception can create a chain. And we saw the chain of deception that was like a stack of dominoes falling through the lives of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Judah. Jeremiah 17:9 says, talks about our inner nature. And it says, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And we don't even know it. Sometimes we don't even perceive it. Sometimes I've heard people who are salesmen say that they heard themselves giving sales presentations about their product as they would like the product to be, not as it really was. And they, at the moment they were saying it, they really believed it. So we have to know the truth, and we have to be committed to the truth and dedicated to telling the truth at all times. Verse 10 says, I, the Lord, search the heart. God can look right down into our hearts. Just as Christ did with Nathanael. Christ was searching Nathanael's heart. There's an example where Christ is watching people throw money into the treasury. And he watches a widow come up and throw in, says, two mites, that's pairings off of a gold or a silver coin. And it says it was her whole living. It was all she had. And the way that Christ was observing this, the Greek word indicates that he wasn't just watching, he was vicariously experiencing what that woman was experiencing. Her love for God, her desire to contribute. She put in all she had. Christ was right there with her, watching her, sensing that, and enjoying it. And I think he was doing the same thing with Nathanael. He had tried Nathanael's hearts, he tried the reins, and he had seen that Nathanael was truly a transparent man, without guile, without dirty tricks, without lies and deceits, and he enjoyed it. So God searches the hearts, and he says, when he searches our hearts, perhaps he sees things that he enjoys, and he experiences vicariously. I try the reins to give every man according to his ways and according to the fruit of his doings. So God truly fed the family of Jacob for several generations with the fruits of their doing. And the consequences, really, of Jacob's deception will not be resolved until the coming of the kingdom of God, because the family of Esau is still contending with the descendants of Jacob. Someone must break up the chain as Joseph did, because we do reap what we sow, and there are consequences for lying and deceit. We've seen that in the lives of the patriarchs, God sometimes added an ironic quick twist to let us know that he was involved in this process. So we should fear the consequences of lying and deceit. Lying reveals a lack of faith in God's ability to work things out, and a lack of faith that we are subject to the consequences of lying. Because there's really two kinds of faith. There's the kind of faith that we all know and count on, the faith that we will have what we ask of God. That's one kind of faith. There's another kind of faith, the faith that God must have what he asks of us. He asks obedience. The faith that there are consequences for disobedience. So resorting to lying and not relying on God to work things out belies a lack of faith in us. And Jacob's own actions at the end of his life show that God is always in control to manage the outcome of our lives. God is always in control. We don't have to do things like deceive and lie to protect ourselves. God is in control. You remember that in Genesis 48, Jacob is dying, and all the sons come before Jacob, and Jacob tells them what will befall their tribes in the last days. And he's going to pass on his inheritance to the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh. And you remember the story. I won't read it for the sake of time. But Joseph brought his two sons to Jacob to be blessed. And he set Manasseh, the eldest, at Jacob's right hand so that Jacob would put the greater blessing on Manasseh. And he put Ephraim over on the left side, the younger son, to receive the lesser blessing. So perhaps everyone in the room had their head bowed, and suddenly Joseph looked up and he saw that Jacob's right hand was on the hand was on the head of the younger child, and his left hand was on the head of the elder. And Jacob, in verse 14 it says, Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands wittingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. Joseph saw that his father laid his right hand upon the head of Ephraim. It displeased him, and he held up his father's hand to remove it from Ephraim's head unto Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, Not so, my father, for this is the firstborn. Put your right hand upon his head. And his father refused and said, I know it, my son, I know it. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great. But truly, his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his seed shall become a multitude of nations. And he blessed them that day, saying, In thee shall Israel bless, saying, God make thee as Ephraim and Manasseh. And he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Now you remember that years earlier, decades earlier, God had told Rebekah, Jacob's mother, that there were two children in her womb and that the elder would serve the younger. Genesis 25 verse 22 says of the two children that Rebekah was carrying, the children struggled together within her, and she said, If it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, Two nations are in your womb, and two manner of peoples shall be separated from your bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. God has said that. Rebekah could not take that for granted. She had to meddle, and to great detriment to her own family. And when her days were delivered, to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the web of deception that affects events to this present day were unnecessary for God to consummate his plan for Jacob. God is a lot more powerful than we have any conception. Now let's turn over to Ephesians. I love this scripture. If we were to lie to protect ourselves or to cover something up, we're denying the power and the resources and the faithfulness of God, just the way that Rebekah denied the power and the resources and the faithfulness of God when she took matters into her own hand and had her son deceive her husband. Ephesians 3:20. Now, unto him that is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that works in us, unto him be glory in the church by Jesus Christ throughout all ages, world without end. Amen. If God has said something, we don't have to lie or deceive or do any other thing that would be sinful in order to make it come to pass. God has such abundant resources, more than we could ask for, more than we could think about. That's the power that God has. So that's one reason that we shouldn't lie. We shouldn't engage in dirty tricks as did the family of Jacob. But lying just once ruins a man's reputation and credibility. Just once. All you have to do is get caught in one lie and you won't be believed after that. But Christ was believed. Christ had authority with the people because his people skills were based on his integrity. It says in Matthew 7:29, he taught as one having authority and not as the scribes. He had credibility with the people. The Psalms and the Proverbs say a lot about lying. Psalm, just to jot down a couple scriptures, Psalm 62, verse 9. Surely men of low degree are vanity, and men of high degree are a lie. To be laid in the balance, they are altogether lighter than vanity. Proverbs 12, verse 17. He that speaks truth shows forth righteousness, but a false witness, deceit. So if a man has a reputation as a false witness, if he's lied once, he is not to be believed. The Proverbs tell you it's a bad bet to believe someone who has already lied to you. Proverbs 14, verse 5, a faithful witness will not lie, but a false witness will utter lies. So don't bring a false witness to the stand. Don't depend on what a false witness tells you. You've got to learn when people are lying to you and trust them zero after that. And our ability is, we're supposed to be influencing the world. Our ability to influence others depends on our reputation for honesty and integrity. And being caught out in one lie or one deception makes us unreliable. It destroys trust. We must be like Nathanael. We must be without guile. Jesus highly regarded the open and honest character of Nathanael. And Jesus can look into the character of his people and can savor their good qualities. Sincerity and truth must be the characteristics of the Christian. God highly values the individual whose character contains no falsehood, no pretense, no false image, no hidden agenda. We need to conduct our lives honestly and let God work out the details. We need to develop the habit of telling the truth, even if it hurts us, as Bonnie told the children. We need to admit our mistakes. We need to be complete as God in heaven is complete. God who cannot lie. God who will not lie. God who is light and in whom is no darkness. Matthew 5:48 says, become perfect or complete even as your Father in heaven is perfect. So just as there are consequences for lying, and the family of Jacob reaped those consequences for generations, there are rewards, there is a payback for honesty and sincerity. So let's turn to one last scripture, Revelation 14. This is the ultimate reward, the ultimate recompense for honesty, sincerity, and truth. Revelation 14, verse 1. Behold, I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung, as it was a new song, before the throne and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000, which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These were redeemed from among men, being the firstfruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth, this is why they have that reward, in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God.